Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly podcast. We provide perspectives on leadership. Today, we're excited to welcome Susan McKenty-Brady. Susan is the Deloitte Ellen Gabriel Chair for Women in Leadership at Simmons University and the Chief Executive Officer of the Simmons University Institute for Inclusive Leadership. As a relationship expert, leadership well-being coach, author, and speaker, Susan educates leaders and executives globally on fostering self-awareness for optimal leadership. She advises executive teams on how to work together effectively and create inclusion and gender parity in organizations. She's a highly sought after authority on emotionally intelligent leadership. She has also been featured on ABC's Good Morning America and has keynoted or consulted at over 500 organizations. She has previously published two books on leadership. Her third, Arrive and Thrive, Seven Impactful Practices for Women Navigating Leadership, is co-authored by Executive Chair of the Board of Deloitte US, Janet Fulte, and Simmons University President, Dr. Lynn Perry Wooten. And this debuted this month and landed on the bestseller list in the Wall Street Journal, Publishers Weekly, and USA Today. Wow, that's a lot of big mouthful. I really appreciate you being here. And I know that we had to change the time because you were with Gloria Steinem yesterday.
I was with Gloria
Steinem. We got to start with that.
Okay. Sue, first of all, thanks for having me.
Sure.
And it's a pleasure to be with you. And thanks for joining everyone. Right. So, you know, we Janet and Lynn and I did a Google Talk a few weeks ago, and the producer of Google Talk also does work under the header of Exponent, which I hadn't heard of. And essentially what they are is they're talking circles with Gloria. She is 88 years old. She is living and working from her home in Manhattan. And she's doing a few of these and they are recorded. So we'll be publishing some version of some of this once they are out. But it's an intimate circle. You know, the tagline of Exponent is we do not get in line, we form circles. And the, you know, it was as generous and generative as you would think. It was just a beautiful conversation. And I'll be honest, like walking into her home was, it was like 1970s Gloria Steinem, like awesomeness, you know, artifacts and just beautiful things everywhere. And she is just lovely and vivid and sharp and fun and just thoughtful. And it was a really cool conversation. So
was it all women? Was it all women in the circle?
It was all women in the circle.
Right. Was there a topic? Like, is there a specific topic?
You know, it was much more generative than I thought. We started with, I'm so used to doing all this press now, and it's like I get the questions in advance, and I have a certain amount of time that I can answer and stuff. So, all the three authors, we were all looking for sort of guidance, and it was started with introduce yourself, and we did. And we ended up talking, interestingly enough, about working and mothering and doing too much and how sort of the, you know, the theme of so much of the difficulty of waking up woman and going to work is managing your responsibilities outside of work and how we negotiate that, be that children or elder care or even just home, whatever it is. And, you know, Gloria didn't have children. The rest of the panel, there was four of us. And then she had two people on her team staff that participated, plus Rebecca. So everybody else was a mom, but Gloria. And she was so curious and interested. And yeah, we got right into it.
Good. Well, speaking of which, you know, I normally start with, you know, a question about your journey, and I will get to that. But I want to start with something that I saw on Twitter when I was looking at your Twitter, and it relates totally with what you just said, because in one of your tweets a couple of days ago, you were quoting, well, actually it's you, it's what you actually said, and I could probably from your book. It says, it's an evergreen riddle for women. On the one hand, we are told to be our authentic self. And on the other hand, the working world wasn't made with us in mind. So it's along the lines of what you're talking about. Could you elaborate on that? Because I not only do I completely agree with it, but I think that it would be well worth hearing your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I have. Okay, so I will confess to you that I believed in meritocracy until probably about 10-ish years ago, when I was confronted with the truth that I might have been naive. And what I mean by that is I really thought if I work hard and, you know, perform and do well and achieve that I would be treated equally to my male counterparts who did the same thing. And I, you know, I have a 19, soon to be 20 year old and a 16, soon to be 17 year old. So I didn't take a big period of time off other than maternity leave, which is, you know, in America for most of us, like no time at all. And so I, you know, I stayed in the workforce and I've worked hard. And the sort of the hard truth I had to come to, and by the way, I was raised by a single father. My mother is in my life, but she lived 250 miles away. And my father, you know, and I had brothers, like, you can do anything you want, Susan. So I really thought, like, I don't know. I mean, why would anything be different for me just because I'm a female? Yeah. What's true is the unconscious biases and the some of the even perpetuated by women, unfortunately, about other women still exists. And so we have to call them out. Mine was, for example, I learned earlier than I have admitted before, Sue, I knew my strengths, you know, so when we think about our best self and leading our life from our best self, it's where your strengths and talents, both born and earned, those that you develop over time, but those that are innate characteristics, when those come together with where you feel called to add value to others, and it also comes together with what brings you joy and vitality, that is your best self zone. And, you know, as soon as you get some clues, like losing track of time, doing something, like just feeling joyful, like looking forward to something, I'm talking on the professional realm, chances are those are clues that you might be in your best self zone. So I knew that I had some skill in communication and in public speaking. And my first foray into thinking about how best to do this led to the gift of feedback that I needed to practice vulnerability, and that I heard some things that weren't very favorable about how I was out for myself. Now, I was talking about my inner critic, and it was really vulnerable. I thought it was really good for women in particular to hear how I get myself back to worthiness. So it didn't feel at all self-serving. And I remember at first thinking, like, what's that about? And then that's literally, I came crashing into the fact that a lot of the systems and the norms, but also the belief systems, right? The belief systems, not just the processes, were actually not made for us to navigate effortlessly, you know, in the professional world. So I remind us of that because we still have work to do.
Okay. So you've written a couple other books. Why this book? Why, what was motivating for you specifically around this one? I know you have co-authors, but like, what was there something specific that happened? You did some research. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, the book, first of all, I mean, I really do believe that, you know, too often our work cultures encourage women to get our foot in the door only to leave us without support once we do. We wrote Arrive and Thrive to change that. But the story behind that is my last large body of work was about how to overcome often hidden hurdles to advancement. So as we go and confront opportunity to do more and to step into more positions of leadership, navigating some of the trickier things that I think probably all underrepresented populations have to navigate, but women comprise the biggest percentage of that. So that was Mastering Your Inner Critic. And when I came to Simmons, two things happened. One was I stepped into this Deloitte Ellen Gabriel chair and was in conversation with some two partners at Deloitte and the president of the university, talking about what kind of project do we want to take on in my tenure as chair. And the conversation wasn't about the project. The conversation was about how all four of us, by any sort of standard, we'd sort of arrived in a very senior level of leadership, really needed to talk still about what was going on, felt lonelier at the top, felt less, in some ways, less resourced interpersonally, intrapersonally, you know, and a lot of demands. And so the pressure, so the stress is higher, the pressure is higher, we have more work to do, and we feel less comfortable being, you know, completely transparent because people are looking to us. It's different than being authentic. And it actually, the idea came out of a circle, a talking circle. I told Gloria this yesterday, the idea for this book did. It's like, wow, you know, we have a lot of collective wisdom about what it would take to thrive. Let's sit down and talk more. And we were set up with Janet and Lynn. It was sort of like a, you know, the current sitting president at Simmons said, you have to work with Lynn. She's the incoming. And the two partners at Deloitte said, I want to introduce you to Janet. Just let's see if there's something here. And the first conversation was like, and, you know, 85 years of collective leadership experience between the three of us, which Nanette doesn't like me to say. And the seven practices emerged pretty quickly. And we did our footwork, right? We did some research, obviously, and culled and distilled more research and then talked to sitting CEOs. So that's how it came to be. And it's I wish I had it sooner, you know, in my life. I don't think you need to arrive to get, you know, value from the practices in the book.
So let's talk about the seven practices. If you could go through them and maybe give some examples of a few of them, that'd be awesome.
The seven practices are both meant to be, you know, intrapersonal used as a source of reflection, but also you can apply to others as you lead and as you grow in other ways. But the first is investing in your best self. And this is, you know, really knowing who you are at your best and how to lead your life from that place as often as you can. So there's two parts to investing in your best self. There's knowing her, and then there's returning to her, which I think this book also, I'll just say, like, we've already gotten feedback that the book is really helpful to all genders, to men, to all. And, you know, the context of the of some of the research that we include, the context of why we thought these practices particularly would be helpful to women is in the book. Nonetheless, the practices hold for everyone, I think. The second is embracing authenticity. So, you know, this is encouraging honesty from yourself about who you really are and helping other people to do the same thing. The third is cultivating courage. And I loved researching and helping to write this chapter because courage is not the absence of fear, as many people know. It's really the presence of vulnerability and confidence mixed together. And I could talk more about courage, but we, you know, you can go in whatever direction you would like. So
yes,
fostering resilience is our fourth practice. And the big aha for me was, you know, when we have a setback, we don't return to the same place from where we left. We return to, you know, hopefully a wiser, more knowing self, you know, and the value of fostering resilience, because this practice kind of annoyed me. I remember laughing with my co-authors about it. I don't want to foster resilience. I don't know about you. Like, I woke up woman, that alone. If you woke up woman of color, you know resilience. If you woke up woman, you know resilience. If you woke up and are any identity that isn't in the majority of power, you know resilience. We've learned it. So fostering it eluded me at first. I was confused by it. And then when I dove into the research and we did a lot of culling and distillations of wisdom out there about this, what it turned out is really, this is a thriving practice for senior women to share their resilience stories and the power of that so that we all can continue to learn and grow.
I like that.
The fifth practice is inspiring a bold vision. And we look at this both for an independent person, like what's my vision, what's my inspired bold vision for myself, and also for the organization and how to go about that. You know, women, I think, you know, have gotten a bad rap about women in the vision thing since the famous HBR article was written. And then we have creating a healthy team environment. And our last one is committing to the work of the inclusive leader. So I would say really the first four practices in particular really help to fuel the last three. And if the practices were in imagery, the bullseye, the center, the core is investing in your best self, because that's from where you lead your life. Want to return? We're kicked out of our best self all the time for all sorts of reasons. We want to come back to her as often as possible, even, you know, in the moment. So we don't say or do things that we regret.
I think this juxtaposition I have a client I'm thinking of right now who, you know, is her best self, and who she is very assertive, and being assertive on Zoom and interrupting people is something that she's kind of getting feedback about. That's negative. So we had to come up with something that felt like she could get in, but not be too interruptive. And so we come up with like interrupting with questions. So she felt like that wasn't losing too much of herself, but yet still taking the feedback. And I think that that's what a lot of us, especially who are assertive, have a problem with, like trying to figure out how to be who we are, but also being collaborative as well. So can you speak to that a bit?
Leadership is a relationship. It's a social construct. And I learned this from several of my mentors over and over again. I make the joke that my job as a leader is to narrow the delta between my intention and my impact, right? Mm-hmm, to be authentic, if part of my authentic self is assertiveness, which it happens to be. What's also important is how I land, how I impact others. And if my timing, if my ferocity, if my intensity of assertiveness is actually having impact on others that makes them not want to pull in and pull up, if it shuts people down or out, it's probably not a winning strategy. And I do need to pivot. And I've talked to a lot of women leaders, I'm sure you have too, and men, who have a personality trait that they're getting feedback on that is frankly a strength overblown or deep non-contextualized, right? So it's not that we're asking you to be less of who you are. We're asking you to be more conscious of how you impact others as you are who you are.
You are.
And know when to moderate your energy.
Yeah, yeah, right? I like that, narrowing the delta between intention and impact. I like that a lot. So let's talk about the pandemic. I don't know when you wrote this book. Was it during it, I assume?
We rallied together as an author team the month before the pandemic. And then it took us like 10 months to get clear what we had and what we wanted to say. And we sent the proposal to a couple publishers.
So
the book was written, the majority of last year.
So given, I figured that it was probably last year. So given that, how has the pandemic affected women's leadership in a way that's differentiated from men? Is there differences to you?
You know, I'd love to hear your opinion on this too. I think the Great Reckoning is mainly a she phenomenon of massive, massive proportion. I am seeing women reconcile their relationships in and outside of work, reconcile their hopes and desires. You know, I'm here as like just a bozo on the bus saying, do not leave yourself out of your own life, right? And if ever there was a time when everything just kind of, you know, we were either forced in or forced out or felt different, you know, everything became acute. Our life is right now. I think women are in a really, really powerful position to negotiate what we need and want for ourselves in a way that we haven't before. Mm-hmm. And I think the Great Reckoning is like on record what's happening when women leave the workforce in droves, when we need to leave. And it's not just hourly. I mean, I'm seeing a phenomenon of knowledge workers as well, really stop and think, do I want to do this anymore? If not this, then what? You know, so
there's a lot of that going on.
A lot of that going on. And look, I think we knew human beings, we need connection and we also want purpose and meaning.
Right.
And the pandemic confronted us with all of it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No question. I'm in total agreement with you. I don't obviously think it's just women. I think it's, you know, reckoning. Yeah. I think it affects women proportionately because they're the ones that are usually, and this is a stereotype, usually dealing with the home. And so there's more juggling, I guess, on the one hand. On the other hand, it might be a little easier for some because they're at home and they can actually juggle what they are doing at home rather than having to commute. So I think that there's a whole commuting backlash. I think people don't want to commute, and they realize that they're feeling better about that. So I think that that's a big issue, and certainly gas prices are not helping that right now.
I know.
That's amazing.
But it does raise a big dilemma, Sue, right? So here's what we're doing is now I've experienced, I don't miss my 2-hour commute that, by the way, in Boston, the way the crow flies, it's just 9 miles to campus, right? I don't miss that. I don't want it. I don't need it. I can be perfectly effective here. The problem is I'm missing out on both the need for social interaction, but also the great political connections to rise. That's happening. And so quality of life, we have yet another trade-off. And so
yeah, there's definitely a trade-off. Yeah.
Super intentional.
Yeah.
Super intentional to be inclusive of the people who remain at home. If there's conversations physically together, you know,
yeah,
it's a hard time to lead right now.
Well, and I think that it's going to be interesting what the data is. There probably is data out there that I haven't seen yet, but who is staying home? Because the office was made for white males. So are the people that are going back, are they mostly white males? I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that's, I would probably venture to guess that the people that are going back are the people that the office was made for in the first place.
We talked about this yesterday. The great advent of flexibility, you know, I used to feel this way about myself and I feel about this about working mothers in particular that I've hired in the past, I was so grateful to get an ounce of flexible time. I would work harder at home and harder at work, you know? And so I think the whole thing comes down to what I would want to call us all to do is really think about what it is that we need in order to have well-being, however you define well-being, right? Just like thriving, I'm not going to define what thriving looks like for you. And I'm not going to define what well-being looks like for you. That's for you to define. But now's the time to sort of look at these parts and think, what do I need? And then we have to courageously go make some requests at home and at work, right? To modify our lives so that we can step fully into our potential, which is part of for me what thriving is, right? Is being very thoughtful and intentional.
Well, I was just going to say, I love the word intentional because you've said it a couple times in different ways. And I think that California, things may be a little bit different here. I don't know, but most people are not going back. And if they are going back, they're going back maybe once a week at the most. So a couple times a month. So there has to be some intentionality around how do we connect? If you're going to be on a team, if we're going to call it a team, then there's a expectation of belonging and inclusiveness. So that means there has to be an intention on the manager's part to actually do that. And I think because in the last 2 years, it's sort of been, everything's been so mishmashy and we weren't sure. Okay, so now we're sure. So now we're sure we're going to have hybrid. So therefore we need to be just as sure about how we're going to connect. And I think that's part of our job is to help managers figure that, because it's going to be on the managers. HR is not putting policies in place. They're just saying, manager, decide what you want to do with your team. So that means the managers have to decide, and they got to be intentional about it. And they've got to talk to their team about it. And sometimes people don't want to, like, they don't care about having relationships at work. Okay. Well, most people do though. So what do you think about that?
Well, this was the topic of our board meeting. So the Institute that I run at Simmons has an incredible board of directors. You can see who's on it if you go to inclusiveleadership.com. Big companies. And we meet quarterly, and we just had our meeting this week. And the topic, we usually do a breakout and do lots of deep dives on a topic. And the topic was, what are you doing when it comes to asking your employees to come back? Are you giving, I call it like faux choice points? So, you know, we're going to go back to the office and you have to be there 3 days a week, but you can choose the three, like your manager can choose the 3 days a week or something like that. So it was a really good discussion. What I'm seeing is the jury is still out on this one. I think there's a lot of experimentation going. Mm-hmm. I also think I just was coaching a woman last week who was really struggling. And she said, I think my team needs to come back and they don't want to. And I was trying to explore with her why she reached that conclusion. And I think there's a lot of preferences, a lot of biases that are driving some of these decisions. And because last I checked, if you're at a knowledge worker job, this isn't the Industrial Revolution. We don't need equipment. Right. So other than what we're looking at, right? So right. I don't know about you, I've been pretty darn productive in this environment. So I think that the decisions need to be driven by the maintenance of psychological safety, yep. Which means it's not that everyone's always happy or everyone gets a vote, but you can bring your unique self to work, however you're bringing it to work. And I want to really make sure you feel like you belong. And so I've got my eye on how connected in are the different members of the team. And you know, because I put my head down and had some my own resilience stories with a death in the family and a cancer scare and medical leave, and I wrote a book. I haven't really been managing per se. I rely on the people on the team to do this. And there's so much subjectivity in all of this when we mm-hmm. don't offer mm-hmm. guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Oh yeah, for sure.
Like a great
sure.
human experiment, this going back to work post-pandemic.
Yes, totally. So going back to your seven practices, I do want to talk about cultivating courage, because I do think that this idea of vulnerability and courage and confidence, the balance of that is difficult. And it's especially difficult on Zoom. So let's assume that even if people go back 1, 2, 3 times a week, it's not going to be more than that. We're going to be on Zoom most of the time. And I think that doing anything on Zoom in terms of expressing and any kind of emoting, influencing, showing emotional intelligence, any of that is harder. So let's focus on the courage part. How do we demonstrate courage in general, and how do we do it on Zoom? the video?
Okay, so kind of the minute the world shut down and we started working like this, I think what happened is the two roles that felt like this became like this, and those are human resource and human being. And we actually saw the human beings with whom we resourced with every day in a different light. And what I think that's awoken in a lot of people is the need to be seen and cared for and feel safe. And it was vulnerable. And I think where cultivating courage comes in, the first, second, and third tip I have about cultivating courage is do not go it alone. We're not meant to do much alone, you know, as you know, Sue. And I think sometimes we forget. I did find some research that we added in the book about people's reluctance to ask others for help. We underestimate by as much as 50% others' willingness to help us. So, you know, it takes courage to do anything you haven't done before, including speak up. And asking for help to do the things we want to do, or that we see, or speaking up or speaking out, it doesn't have to be in a Zoom when multiple people are popped in. It can be one-on-one, it can be on the side, but I'd say, you know, noticing when the last time you recognized something that made you feel nervous or scared and how you managed it. So starting to pay attention, first of all, to the moments of like, when you feel your heart race a little bit because you want to speak up and you shy away, like what are those moments where you need to sort of step in and take risks? And then I remind people a lot of the time that very rarely do we fall flat on our face and stay there forever. If we do fall flat, we get right back up, and that's when we go to fostering resilience. And oftentimes the risks that we take aren't nearly as scary when we take them as we thought they would be. And so that's where borrowing confidence comes in. I've used that a lot. My first book, I'd never written a book before. I had little imposter-esque thoughts, like who the hell am I to write a book? I happen to be in the leadership development field, surrounded by people who were best-selling authors, some of them at our big conferences. And I befriended a few people and said, can you help me understand how to go about this? And what do I wanna, I got the metaphor of the whale's belly, which helped me through my very first big book, which was, you know, you go in thinking there's light and you don't see it for a while because you're like head down, any big project is right. But that metaphor got me through those darker days of like just the slog of feeling like, oh my God, I have to produce a manuscript. So it's things, that's just an example. I borrowed courage, I borrowed wisdom, I asked for just help me understand. Sometimes I just needed to talk. And so I think so much about developing, cultivating courage for ourselves is looking around and seeing other people have probably done something that like what I've done.
Right. Well, you know, when we start coaching with people, in the beginning, before they even decide to work with us, and particularly if they're, you know, they're always one-on-one calls, right? I find myself normalizing people's experiences that, because they're there by virtue that they want help. I mean, clearly, you know, if you have a coach, you're looking for support. Just to get to that step is a big deal. And then the next step is like to demonstrate to them that what they're feeling and what they're experiencing is normal. And other people feel the same way. Other executives feel the same way, because there is this misnomer that there's no one else that feels this way, and that's why people don't want to ask for help, because it's too vulnerable, because they don't think that anybody feels this way. And there is a ton of imposter stuff going on. I mean, we all feel it. I feel every day in different ways. So there is this lack of wanting to ask for support, which is why coaches actually, there's even a market for coaches, because they're willing to do that. That's like cachet in a way, right? But not necessarily willing to get help from their peers, which we of course encourage, because we encourage peer coaching all over the place. And in fact, if there was more peer coaching, there'd probably be less reason for us to exist. So,
although I have to say, I've had several amazing coaches, and I've had the opportunity. I don't know about you and your colleagues. I learn sometimes more. I feel like sometimes I learn more from my clients than they do from me in a coaching engagement.
Yes.
Because it's so much easier to be clear about someone else's journey.
Right. Exactly. Yes. That happens all the time.
But you know, the reason why I think, you know, most executives could and should reach out step into a coaching engagement at some point in their careers, particularly when you're at the top, is in part to have a sounding board of someone who has your back. And I think part of the fear of not, I think peer group is the most under-leveraged, under-resourced support group of all time. And what drives us from not doing it, A, we're all busy, busy, busy. We're either managing up or managing down. But we neglect the power of having a circle with our peers out of fear. I think it's really fear-based. How will they use this information? What's people's agenda? You know, we're fighting for resources in one meeting and the next meet, right? We're supposed to be like collaborating. And that's where it's safe to sort of strategize with a coach and think, okay, you know, what are the, what, you know, what's the best way to navigate this that's going to land like I intended to, as opposed to just, you know, rushing out the door. But I'm a big fan of coaching. I just engaged with a coach who was instrumental in helping me birth this book, not from a content perspective, but to help me get over my own stuff about not stepping fully into my, to leveraging my brand. I mean, I've been sort of out there a lot in the past 8 years-ish, and I couldn't bring myself to, you know, post or, you know, it all felt like bragging. And because I was criticized about that earlier in my career, I was so sensitive. Like, I don't want anybody to think I'm out for myself. God help me, you know? And I just want you to know, I just, this last week gave all of my social media platforms over to help with a team of people who are helping me do it, because I couldn't, that was such a big move, but a coach helped me get there. Like, you know what I'm hearing, Susan, is you will be a blocker in your own way on this particular thing. And it's really okay for you not to have to do it yourself. And I was like, blah, like blew my mind.
That's great. That's great. Okay. I want to shift gears here a little bit. I want to talk about burnout. So I want to talk about the sort of the other side of this, because I think that there's quite a bit of that going on. And again, this might be affecting women more because they're just taking on more. I mean, I do 4 Zoom calls and I'm like spent, and most of our clients are doing 8 a day, at least. I don't even know how that even works, but you know, whatever. And they're not sleeping as much. And then there's all sorts of things going on in terms of work-life balance. But I am concerned about burnout. I'm concerned about depression. I'm concerned about sleeplessness. What are you seeing? And what do you have to say about how we can deal with this? And you actually use the word anti-ambition as well in your book, which I think is really interesting. I had a guy who was a good friend of mine, who I used to coach, say, I just don't want to work as much anymore. I'm like, and he doesn't have to, which is part of it, because he's made it. But it's like, but he doesn't really want to. And I think that's I would be an example of anti-ambition, I guess.
So look, I think time is, our energy is our most precious commodity. It diminishes as the hours roll. I think that we are beginning to experience what will probably be the greatest mental health crisis of our time. And we're woefully under-resourced for it, right? Not only for access to therapists, but access to, you know, tools, and it's happening not just for those of us in the professional world, it's happening for our children, you know, anxiety and depression. We see it all over the place. And stress and fatigue. And I think, you know, that there won't be a company in, I think in 5 years, it doesn't have a chief well-being officer, just like, you know, in the early 90s, there came to be the chief diversity officer, you know, not just special companies that were great places to work for, but everybody, because we have to keep our employees well and mentally well. The good news, I think, is that this is going to open up a place to talk about, you know, mental well-being in a way that people don't feel shamed about it. You know?
That's what we got to get to.
I'm happy to use, I mean, I use myself. I mean, part of the first practice of investing in your best self, the latter, you know, first is coming to know her and the latter is returning. The return is all about, self-esteem, and it's about holding ourselves in warm regard and knowing that we are imperfect human beings. And so we will err, but we need to have a way to shore up internally inside of ourselves and come back to a place of enoughness in ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we also need to do it with other people. So when we feel disappointed with the people around us, because I don't know about you, but I just am more short-tempered after 2 years of pandemic. I know my fuse is shorter because I'm tired, or because, you know, because. And I have to sort of pay attention pretty quickly if I'm feeling some level of disappointment, be it at home or even with the people I work with. And my tone and my affect. And so practicing, hey, I want to check in with how I landed, gives other people permission to do that too. And if I practice this, if I walk this, then I'm okay calling on one of my direct reports and saying, you know, I think, let's talk about what happened just now, because I think your intention was X. Here's how it landed for me. What's going on? And what I'll likely hear, oh my gosh, my kid's daycare was
overwhelmed,
closed,
or
all the things, right? I think most leaders are woefully ill-prepared for this as well, because
I don't think they're even asking. So I think we need to be asking, you know, we need to be asking, like you asked, you said, well, hey, that just happened. That was different. Like what happened, like what's going on with you? I think that we need to ask, because we're going to find out a whole shitload of stuff that's going on that people are trying to manage in the background. You mentioned kids, like as much as I have hated the pandemic, I'm a big extrovert and it's been horrible. My poor kid who's 16, you know, to go through a pandemic at 14 or 15, it's like, it's just horrible. So I just like, as bad as I feel, he feels worse. So I just could have like put my energy toward him, because it's just, if you're an extrovert and you've lost connection with people, it's really difficult. It's really hard.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest opportunity from a mental health standpoint is isolation is dangerous.
Yes, it is. But especially for extroverts.
For everybody. I see myself as socially I'm under-socialized. I got this from one of my friends and mentors, under-socialized. And then yet when I went back, I had like 10 events in 7 days a couple weeks ago. And I had to like get dressed and wear pants that zip and like shoes that like were presentable outside my home. I mean, it was just a hot mess. I went out and I realized I am so ill prepared to make small talk. As under socialized as I was, what am I talking about? Like, oh my God. It's almost like we have to re-enculture ourselves.
There's no question about it. It's like we have to put the pants on and we have to put our small talk hat on. Seriously. Yeah, it's I think it's okay. I mean, I think everybody, I think we realize it. So we kind of got to the under-socialized. I like that word, under-socialized. I do think that there's an issue with isolation. I do. And I think that there's a difference between loneliness and solitude. I think that there's been a lot of lessons that we've had to learn around that and how we've been able to practice that more because we've been in the pandemic. But when solitude goes to loneliness, I think that's an isolation is causing that. I think that's a different matter. Our last Wise Talk guest actually talked about loneliness. And I mean, what are you seeing in this? I think this is part of the issue around the well-being and the mental crisis you're addressing. I mean, I think that's part of it. So say more about that.
So first of all, I just have to say, Sue, I love the distinction between solitude and loneliness. Mm-hmm. It's really, I could kind of geek out with you about that alone, but the remedy I think now's the time. If you're not journaling already, folks, start to journal. I mean, there's so much richness in giving yourself time with your own thoughts and feelings mm-hmm. and expressing them, even if they seem jumbled and crazy, to write it down and get it out mm-hmm. And then to talk to others about it. I think the time is now to be conscious. And when I talk about intention or thoughtfulness or consciousness, it starts with a framework of self-awareness and it goes to a framework of self-management, which means tuning in and tuning up. If your heart feels lonely, if you feel like you're sad, that's probably a good indication that you should call your best friend, reach out to, you know, someone who you love and trust, make a connection, right? Because it's a slippery slope. Different from, I'm at the point where, yes, I'm, you know, with a book release and it got on bestselling. I mean, I've heard from more people in the last 3 weeks of my life than I have in the last 10 years combined. And I love it. And I'm doing all these kinds of podcasts and everything. I love it. And I'm craving alone time.
Right.
And it's solitude. It's not, I'm not worried about people, you know, I'm not worried about being lonely. And so I think the skill. And again, coaching can help. I'm not trying to like, you know, buoy our profession, but I'm just saying like, I'm probably preaching to the choir. I think part of what we need to offer in our redesign of value when it comes to executive coaching is allowing for restoration and rejuvenation and teaching leaders how to do that. Because mm-hmm. here's the thing, if we don't do it, we will burn out. And mm-hmm. last mm-hmm. I checked, our organizations desperately need us. Desperately totally. Need us.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Lots of good things. Anything, any last thoughts? There's a lot of great, great things we talked about. Anti-ambition. I love the vulnerability and confidence. I like that a lot.
have to say, like, I'm a big fan of Adam Grant's work on rethinking, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the red thread, other than don't go it alone, that runs through all the seven practices is for sure leading with a curious mind. I mean, mm-hmm. nothing works when you don't, let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I would want to end with is reminding us all to be gentle with ourselves, mm-hmm. and gentle mm-hmm. with the people around us. If ever, I was saying this before the pandemic, like, everybody chill out. I mean, my gosh, like, can you just mm-hmm. be a little more gentle on your self-criticism? Can you be a little more gentle mm-hmm. on your expectations of others, of how fast and hard you're rowing the boat? And P.S., that was for me too, you know? Gosh, if that was needed 3 years ago, it sure as shit's needed yeah, right now.
That's right.
Okay. Right. And I have a sign in my office that says, get gentle with it. I give it to every single one of my coaching clients.
I love it. I love that. Yeah, the article that I penned last year that still is relevant is, you know, we need to get the armor off, you know, it's the same.
Yeah, the veneer of perfection, guess what, folks, like, it's cracked. And you didn't do it. The world orchestrated that for us. Now what do you do?
That's right. That's right. Well, it's been lovely to be with you. I want to just give everybody some more information. It's Susan McKenty. It's McKenty Brady. And you can find her on LinkedIn. You can also find her on the website Arrive and Thrive, and her Twitter is @SMcKentyBrady, @SMcKentyBrady. Again, the book is Arrive and Thrive, 7 Impactful Practices for Women Navigating Leadership.
So, and all that's on arriveandthrive.com too.
Yeah,
so
come. Arrive and Thrive. I love it. I love it. Arrive and Thrive. So thanks again, everybody. See you guys next time. Thanks again, Susan.
Here's to thriving, everybody.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bye.